Will Trump go from planning World War III to accepting the Nobel Peace Prize? And will the Washington Press Corps continue to cry wolf? It's an apologetic edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Four states hold primaries on Tuesday, including West Virginia, where a convicted former mine owner may be jeopardizing GOP hopes in November.
Blankenship is running in opposition to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, among the three main Republicans seeking to oppose Manchin. Establishment-minded Republicans view him as the candidate they would least see to oppose Joe Manchin in the fall.
Plus, with President Trump having him in his crosshairs, should Montana's John Tester be concerned about his political future?
He voted against the tax cuts. He voted against Neil Gorsuch's confirmation. He voted against Betsy DeVos' confirmation. He's taken a lot of votes on a lot of key issues against the president. So I don't think it should come as a surprise to anyone that he's in the sights of Republicans.
And after the uproar over the White House Correspondents' Dinner, could some changes be in store for next year?
I think right now the real source of conflict is the entertainment. We nix it. We go there, we network, it's fantastic networking, you see and be seen, and you honor the scholarship winners, and you honor your colleagues. It's not that hard.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, 'cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 227 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. You know Washington is a wacky place when, after coming back from a vacation out of the country, you return to hear things like this.
President Trump, if he can lead us to ending the Korean War after 70 years and getting North Korea to give up their nuclear program in a verifiable way, deserves the Nobel Peace Prize and then some.
That was South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox News, repeating something that others, including the president of South Korea, have said, that Trump should get the Nobel Peace Prize if the Korean Peninsula ends its seven decades of tension. The president himself heard it last Saturday night at a rally in Michigan.
I'm not going to give you what's going to actually happen because we don't really know. But I'll tell you one thing, we're not playing games. And I remember, you know, it was very rough 3-4 months ago. That's very nice. Thank you. That's very nice. Nobel.
Yes, this is the guy who was talking about fire and fury and bigger bombs just a few months ago. But who knows? President Obama was in office 15 minutes when he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. Even though it's hard to make the case that he had done much of anything to achieve peace, other than launching drone attacks that cost many lives. And what if a real peace comes out of Korea? So we'll see. More impressive was President Trump's understanding of how slavery came to an end in the U.S. We learned that last Thursday during a rambling half-hour call into his favorite TV program, Fox and Friends, where the conversation started with the news about how much Kanye West likes the president.
Have Republicans done a bad job ignoring the black community up until now?
You know, I think it was just a custom. People don't realize, you know, if you go back to the Civil War, it was the Republicans that really did the thing. Lincoln was a Republican. I mean, it somehow it changed over the years. And I will say, I really believe it's changing back.
So remember, whenever you're asked how slavery came to an end, it's because Republicans did the thing. Seriously, if you have 30 minutes to spare, you should really listen to Trump's chat with his Fox and Friends friends. Some pretty amazing stuff. It's because Republicans did the thing. Here's a few other quick observations worth mentioning. The Senate confirmed the nomination of Mike Pompeo to be Secretary of State by a vote of 57 to 42. Most interesting thing about the vote, Rand Paul, the Kentucky Republican who threatened to vote against Pompeo because of foreign policy concerns, not surprisingly caved in and voted yes. And five Democratic senators who were seeking re-election this year in states won by Trump, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, and Bill Nelson in Florida also voted to confirm Pompeo. Another Democrat seeking another term is Robert Menendez of New Jersey. He was, quote, severely admonished by the Senate Ethics Committee for accepting gifts from a wealthy doctor while at the same time using his position to promote the doctor's business interests. Still, he remains favored to win re-election in a state that hasn't elected a Republican to the Senate since 1972. Utah is a state that hasn't elected a Democrat to the Senate since 1970. That is not likely to change this year either. But it was a bit of a surprise to see Mitt Romney lose his bid for the GOP nomination at the state convention. He's still favored to win the primary on June 26. Also last week, Republicans held on to the Arizona House seat vacated by Trent Franks, who quit over a sex scandal. It was a badly needed win, especially after defeats in special elections in Alabama and Pennsylvania. But the margin was only 5 points in a district Trump won by 21. More hand-wringing for the GOP. In a moment, we'll look at the 4 states holding primaries on Tuesday, including Ohio. There, Mike DeWine, a former senator, is running for governor. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last senator defeated for re-election who later went on to win the governorship? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Even though I hate it, I'm gonna take it until I win. Cause I'm a comeback kid. Don't know what bad things happen, but they did. I don't think I deserve the hurt I get.
There have been no state and congressional primaries since March, when Illinois and Texas voted, and that is unacceptable. That changes next Tuesday, when voters in 4 states go to the polls, in Indiana, North Carolina, Ohio, and West Virginia. A lot of attention is on Indiana and West Virginia, 2 states where Democratic incumbents are thought to be in trouble, but Republican infighting could hurt GOP chances. And there's an interesting Democratic primary for governor in Ohio, where familiar ideological divisions are in view. Here with a roadmap for Tuesday's contest is Greg Giroux, a political reporter for Bloomberg. Greg, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Great to be with you.
Well, let me start in West Virginia, because I think the Republican Senate primary there is really interesting. A few weeks ago on this show, we talked about how both Congressman Evan Jenkins and State Attorney General Patrick Morrissey are trying to outdo each other in their admiration for President Trump. What can you tell us about them, and what is that race looking like?
Well, it's the West Virginia Senate race is one of the top targets for Republicans who are trying to defend their 2-seat majority in the Senate, 51-49, and they like to protect that by winning what is the most pro-Trump state of any that's being defended by a Democratic senator this year, in this case by Joe Manchin. Trump carried it by more than 40 percentage points, and so that's why you're seeing a lot of the pro-Trump sentiment being expressed by the Republican candidates seeking to oppose Manchin. Evan Jenkins, as you mentioned, he's a congressman from the 3rd District of West Virginia, the southern part of the state. Probably the most hard scrabble of the districts. He's been there for 2 terms and is looking to advance to the Senate. And then Patrick Morrissey is the state attorney general, running on a pro-Trump platform as well, but also brandishing his service as state attorney general. He's mentioning Barack Obama quite a bit, who has a poor showing in that state when he ran for president. And Morrissey is running against what he says are the excesses from Obama's EPA. So sometimes it's hard listening to these advertisements. You know, is Trump president or is Obama president? Because they're running very strong pro-Trump and anti-Obama campaigns in West Virginia.
There's a 3rd candidate, Don Blankenship, and he's pretty controversial.
He is. He is a former coal mogul who served in prison for a year after jurors a few years ago found him guilty for evading federal safety rules after a 2010 mine explosion killed 29 workers. Joe Manchin was governor at the time, so there's a Blankenship, I think, wants to, is running in part to oppose Manchin. I think he wants to make this a little personal. He has Blankenship is running in opposition to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, among the three main Republicans seeking to oppose Manchin, and he is basically financing this race out of his own pocket. I think probably close to $5 million of his own money he spent to blanket the state with advertisements that promote himself, but also attack Jenkins and Morrissey as kind of more conventional politicians.
Well, you mentioned that he's running against McConnell, and I mean, we saw Roy Moore do that in his Senate race in Alabama last December. But this ad is a little bit weird. Let me just play a little bit of this clip.
Politicians are running a lot of crazy ads. They blew up the coal mine and then put me in prison. Now they're running ads that say the coal mine blew up and I went to prison. There's no surprise there. But if you want jobs, if you want to end the drug epidemic and you want to protect the unborn, you need to vote for me.
So there's no emotion and everything is reading, none whatsoever. And then he starts to smile and reads this tagline, and there's absolutely no explanation. Let me play this.
One of my goals as U.S. Senator will be to ditch Cocaine Mitch.
To ditch Cocaine Mitch. And that's all he says. We assume he's talking about Mitch McConnell, but what does that mean?
Yeah, very unusual candidate and a very unusual campaign. So his reference to Cocaine Mitch. He's attacking McConnell's family members through his wife, Elaine Chao, who serves in the Trump cabinet. He's making some allegations about her father and some shipping businesses, and that's what he's tried to slap on McConnell. But as you note, that ad doesn't really explain too much about where he's coming from there. But that's sort of his what he's doing in this campaign is running against the establishment and trying to link Evan Jenkins and Patrick Morrissey to the political establishment, and saying he'd be better to combat the state's opioid crisis and to bring jobs to the state. He says that Jenkins and Morrissey haven't created jobs on their own while he has. But it's a very, very atypical, unusual candidate and campaign, and his attacks on McConnell have not gone unnoticed by allies of the Senate Majority Leader for a super political action committee, a super PAC that can accept donations in unlimited amounts, has spent more than $1.3 million on advertisements attacking Blankenship, who the Republican establishment, for lack of a better term, views as the weakest candidate to oppose Joe Manchin.
Convicted criminal Don Blankenship.
This game is about money.
Blankenship made $17.3 million 1 year and traveled the country on a private jet. At the same time, he cut the pay and benefits of minors 6% and laid off hundreds. Then the Upper Big Branch disaster killed 29 men. Blankenship was convicted of conspiracy to violate mine safety laws. Don Blankenship was about the money. West Virginia families paid the price. Mountain Families PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Greg, I would assume by listening to that ad, it seems like Republicans see Blankenship as the most flawed candidate they could put up against Joe Manchin.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that ad just underscores the fact that there's more than $1.3 million of super PAC ads attacking Blankenship, just underscores that kind of establishment-minded Republicans view him as the candidate they would least see to oppose Joe Manchin in the fall. They'd rather see Congressman Evan Jenkins or State Attorney General Patrick Morrissey.
Now, there's another nasty Republican primary going on in Indiana, also for the Senate. There are three candidates running, hoping to take on Joe Donnelly, the Democratic incumbent. Two congressmen, Luke Messer and Todd Rokita, and businessman Mike Braun. And all three of them, actually, like West Virginia, all three of these candidates in Indiana are trying to make the case that each one is more pro-Trump than the others.
Yeah, that's true. So Todd Rokita, he represents Indiana's 4th District, which is, northwest of Indianapolis, a very Republican district. He was formerly Indiana's Secretary of State. He's been running as a very pro-Trump campaign in his television ads. He's been donning the red Make America Great Again hats that we commonly associate with the Trump movement and campaign. Luke Messer is a congressman from Indiana's 6th District, which is eastern Indiana, a lot of the same turf that Vice President Mike Pence represented when he was in the Congress. He, too, running a pro-Trump campaign, portraying himself as a consistent conservative. And then the third candidate in the race, Mike Braun, is a former state legislator, but he's also very personally wealthy from owning an auto parts distribution business, and he's sunk almost $6 million of his own money into a Republican primary. He was probably a distant third when this race began, and I don't think that Rakita and Messer paid him as much close attention as they are now. And so Braun has really risen as he's had $6 million of his own money in this race. And, you know, he's running as a political outsider. He portrays Rakita and Messer as like-minded, quote-unquote, career politicians. Braun was not in the state legislature for that long. And, you know, he appears in shirt sleeves to kind of maybe symbolize his outsider status. And he says that he's more in line with Trump because he's a businessman who was successful in that in the private sector. So, yeah, it's a very competitive three-way race. It's gotten pretty fractious for a few months now. And the winner would face Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly, who, like Manchin, is trying to defend a state that went strongly for Trump, although Indiana is not as strongly pro-Trump as West Virginia is.
The third state, the third of the four states that are voting on, that's voting on Tuesday is North Carolina. There's no Senate or governor race this year, but Walter Jones, the anti-establishment Republican congressman, has another primary challenge. That seems he seems to be challenged a lot from establishment-type Republicans.
That's right. Congressman Walter Jones has been in the Congress since 1994. He says this will be his last term. He's an iconoclastic, kind of libertarian-tinged conservative, takes an anti-war positions, and has bucked the leadership on votes that include opposing John Boehner twice for Speaker and Paul Ryan once for Speaker. He voted against the Republican tax cut law on the grounds that he said it would exacerbate budget deficits. His votes against spending bills, very much a deficit hawk. But his party bucking ways have drawn him primary opponents the last three elections, this one included, and his opponent this time is Scott Dacey, a county commissioner, a lobbyist who says that he would be a more reliable supporter of Trump's agenda than Congressman Jones. Dacey has drawn some support from current and former members of Congress, Republican members of Congress. It's very rare to see members of Congress oppose one of their own in a primary challenge, but that is in fact the case. And one of Dacey's most recent donors is former Speaker John Boehner, who whose Political Action Committee just cut a check to Scott Dacey's campaign.
That leaves us with Ohio. Now, the Senate race, I don't think there's much excitement on Tuesday. It's Democratic Sherrod Brown seeking a third term, and the likely Republican is Congressman Jim Renacci. You know, I know you don't focus too much on gubernatorial races, but let me just a quick mention of what's going on in the Ohio governor's race. That's the one where John Kasich is leaving. He's term limited. Mike DeWine is the leading Republican candidate. He's a former senator and the front runner for governor.
That's right. Mike DeWine, if his name should sound familiar to your listeners, and well so, because he is a he's a veteran Republican hand in the state's politics, a county prosecutor, congressman, U.S. senator. After losing his seat in 2006 to Sherrod Brown, who is now defending it for a third term, he came back and was elected state attorney general. And like Patrick Morrissey in the West Virginia Senate race, DeWine's campaign kind of focuses heavily on his work as attorney general, running against the Obama administration with his work on as AG. And his opponent is Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, elected on a ticket in 2010 with John Kasich and reelected in 2014, although Taylor and Kasich have kind of gone their separate ways when it comes to how they handle the Trump factor. DeWine was the overwhelming favorite in the primary early on. Taylor has spent a lot of money in the last few months and has narrowed the gap, although I don't know if it'll be enough to overtake DeWine in that primary.
And you have two Democrats. I think this is interesting, probably the most interesting Democratic primary we've come across so far in this year. And that's for governor. The establishment choice seems to be Richard Cordray. He's the former state attorney general, and he used to be the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau director. His predecessor was Elizabeth Warren, who's endorsed him. But his opponent in the race is Dennis Kucinich, and everybody remembers him, a former mayor of Cleveland, former congressman, former presidential candidate, and he's being backed by many Bernie Sanders supporters. So the two of them, both Cordray and Kucinich, are progressives, but it seems like the left is being split on this race as well.
Yes, I think that's right. And Cordray, as you mentioned, he directed the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, was the first director of it, the bank regulating agency that is closely associated with Elizabeth Warren. So the fact that he's a close ally of Elizabeth Warren kind of underscores his kind of bona fides with kind of liberal or progressive groups. Like the Republican candidates, the Democratic candidates have long histories in Ohio politics. You know, Cordray previously was Ohio Attorney General and Treasurer and Solicitor General and was briefly a state legislator. And he's running a campaign that kind of emphasizes the, you know, protecting your money theme in the jobs he's held at the state level, but also at the federal level. His advertisements show him aligned with former President Barack Obama, calls himself the top consumer watchdog. And then Dennis Kucinich, well-known to politics watchers in Ohio and outside as the boy mayor of Cleveland in his early 30s and the late 1970s, congressman for 16 years until 2012, and Democratic presidential bids. And as you mentioned, backed by some supporters of Bernie Sanders, which has would lead to believe that maybe the left is split here, although I'd be surprised if Cordray lost the primary.
What race are you going to be watching the most closely on Tuesday? What do you think the big headline is going to be?
I think the two big races to watch are the Republican primaries for the U.S. Senate in West Virginia and Indiana, just because, you know, I think there's been a lot of attention, and rightly so, placed on the campaign for control of the U.S. House, which could very well flip from Republican to Democratic. The math for the Democrats to win control of the Senate is much harder. But, you know, you can't really discount it just because if there is a kind of a one-sided so-called wave here, a lot of the close Senate races can break one way. And you could very well see most, if not all, of the Democratic incumbents keep their seats. But it is very important to find out which Republican nominees are chosen to oppose Joe Manchin in West Virginia and Joe Donnelly in Indiana, just because their states were very pro-Trump in 2016.
Greg Giroux works for Bloomberg and is one of the best political reporters in the country, if I do say so myself. Greg, it's great having you on the show.
Thank you. You're too kind.
I'm a political man, and I practice what I preach. I'm a political man, and I practice what I
I realize it's not easy pointing out the foibles and peculiarities of the Beltway mentality on this show because, well, when all is said and done, I'm part of it. I've been living in the D.C. area for more than three decades. But a lot of those peculiarities have been on display this week in the aftermath of Saturday's White House Correspondents' Dinner. In case you haven't heard, I'm just kidding, I'm sure you've heard, the nation's capital has been in an uproar following the remarks made at the dinner by Michelle Wolf. Wolf is a comedian who has been known to tell jokes that can, on occasion, cross a line, and then some. The White House Correspondents' Association knew that when they invited her. And, as expected, some jokes did cross a line, or at least many people thought they had. Some were quite funny, and not everyone was aimed at President Trump.
Crazy that the Trump campaign was in contact with Russia when the Hillary campaign wasn't even in contact with Michigan.
It's a direct flight. It's so close.
But many were. They mocked Trump, who for the second year in a row had boycotted the dinner, as well as Vice President Pence, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Speaker Paul Ryan, Presidential Advisor Kellyanne Conway, and White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who was sitting on the dais. There were laughs from the audience of journalists, but there was also a lot of astonished looks and even some uncomfortable silence. Amber Phillips is a reporter with the Washington Post who attended and wrote about the dinner. Amber, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, remind us what the Correspondents' Dinner is supposed to be all about.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. It's supposed to celebrate the First Amendment and the journalists, especially in D.C., who work tirelessly to try to uphold that. And we typically invite politicians and celebrities and presidents, going back to Calvin Coolidge, have attended at least one, to kind of partake in celebrating journalism.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, they have in the past, for the longest time, they would invite their sources, you know, usually members of Congress or cabinet officials. But then in the late 1980s, I remember they invited Fawn Hall, who was Oliver North's secretary during the Iran-Contra scandal. And I remember people saying, whoa, what's going on here? This is not the way we do these things. And then they started inviting Donna Rice, and they invited Lindsay Lohan and all these stars. And it seemed to go downhill from there.
Yeah, I think up until the Trump era, this was seen as like Washington's moment to have Hollywood come and hang out with the journalists. You're absolutely right that it was just like the dinner was known as, you know, the red carpet event where you have movie stars and TV stars and entertainers like wanting to hang out with journalists who are typically behind the scenes most of the time. And so it really became a big deal, and the celebrity aspect of it. And that all stopped rather abruptly in the Trump era for a few reasons, not least of which is the president decided not to attend. So why fly from L.A. or New York if you're a celebrity if the president's not going to be there?
Well, even before we get to the Trump controversy, I mean, and even forgetting about all the fact that the celebrities were getting more attention than the people ostensibly there to be honored, as you point out, the journalists themselves. But the bigger picture, the bigger complaint about the dinner has long been, and you've written about this, is that there's something unseemly, it seems that journalists are partying with the politicians there covering, that a line is getting crossed.
Right. I think the dinner, fairly or not, I can't speak for every journalist who's there, it gives off the perception that there's a coziness between journalists and their sources, which then gives the perception that journalism is a transactional industry, right? That, like, kind of you scratch my back and give me this whatever inside look at the administration and I'll do something for you. Like, hey, would you like this ticket for this dinner, you know, where all these celebrities are and the president speaks and free food and free alcohol and whatever. And it just, like, fairly or not, doesn't help the narrative that a growing number of people have over the years that journalism has an agenda.
And then it even seemed to get, I mean, I used to attend them pretty frequently. It's funny, when I used to go there, I was with ABC News and then NPR, and for all the years I went, I loved it, and now that I don't go anymore, I hate it. So it's kind of hypocritical, and I'm the first to admit that. But I remember sitting at the 2006 dinner where Stephen Colbert was bashing President Bush and the media, and almost everybody I know who watched it on TV loved it. But I remember so many of us sitting in there, sitting inside the room at the Hilton, we were cringing, like, wow, he's really brutal. I mean, I was looking at Bush's face during much of the evening, and he, you know, he had a frozen smile on. But I thought that was when something seemed to change, that Colbert seemed to cross that line that everybody said that Michelle Wolf crossed last Saturday.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was not at that 2006 dinner, but I was at Saturday's, and immediately after Michelle finished, a bunch of people who are veterans like you turned and went, whoa, that was the craziest thing I've seen since Stephen Colbert, and even more so. And it kind of, I think both those moments raise this awkward question of, you know, here journalists are giving entertainers a platform to speak their minds, and what happens when they take that platform and make it more political than journalists would like? Is it on the journalists? That certainly seems to be, I feel like, the source of the controversy and the internal, oh my gosh, what did we do wrong this time, conversations in our industry right now after Saturday.
Here's the thing, though. A lot of people said that journalists should apologize to Sarah Sanders because Michelle Wolf went so far. That's what NBC's Andrea Mitchell said. And you wrote this. Let me quote you something you wrote in the Post. You said, everyone agrees on one thing. Inviting comedian Michelle Wolf to address the journalist at the dinner did not go as planned. But didn't she do exactly the kind of routine that she always does? I mean, this is exactly who Michelle Wolf is.
I think that's a totally fair criticism, Ken, of the dinner and the association and everyone who was there. You know, she made a joke early on. She goes, should have done your research before you had me on.
I love that.
Yeah, the first, like, really uncomfortable laugh in the room. And I think that's totally fair criticism, knowing that this moment of the dinner can be a major controversy, as you cite Stephen Colbert more than a decade ago, that can have reverberate, you know, for years. Why invite an entertainer, a comedian who's known for being this controversial? It's a fair question. And the White House Correspondents Association president, Margaret Tavev for Bloomberg, who generally everyone loves here in Washington, you know, she did a statement afterward the next day and said that this wasn't really what our association stands for.
You know something, I think that's the part that I'm trying to get at. Her statement and Peter Baker of the Times said that the dinner didn't serve the cause of journalism. Well, I mean, the journalists who were there are doing the job of journalism. The entertainers are just entertaining. But Stephen Colbert didn't necessarily, you know, serve the cause of journalism by making fun of President Bush. In other words, are we confusing journalists with the comedians whom the Correspondents Association invite as entertainers?
My personal opinion is I don't think journalists are confusing anyone. I think that in this day and age, there's a line that can't be drawn, right? This is like the one dinner that the nation actually knows about involving journalists. And when we host comedians that are critical of the politicians we're trying to cover and some of us are there laughing at it, you can't separate journalism from the entertainers there. And I think especially this day and age when journalism is under attack for its impartiality and in some cases journalists' physical safety, especially by this president.
I think the point you're making is probably been understated in this whole debate, and I think it's a very important point in the fact that journalists find themselves either deciding whether to laugh or not laugh at a dinner like this puts the journalistic community in some kind of difficulty.
I think that's exactly right. I don't think in this day and age journalists get to draw a distinction anymore between people we hosted to dinner who criticize the president and ourselves. This is just not a moment in time to blur any of the lines of impartiality, because you look at headlines, and I can point you to research that has summed all this up, that shows that the majority of our coverage is critical of the president. And you could argue he's someone who deserves that. He's doing things that have never been done before. And he's under an investigation by the special counsel, for goodness sakes. But even if journalists say, well, we weren't the ones making fun of Trump, I don't think in this day and age it's our job we don't even get a right, I should say, to host someone to make fun of Trump.
They're talking about changing future dinners. How would Amber Phillips, how would you change the dinners from here on out? I mean, you mentioned ending the schmoozing, the coziness that the politicians, between the politicians and the journalists, but what would you do to change it as far as, let's say, entertainment?
Yeah, I think you zeroed in on exactly what needs to be changed because, you know, this is a whole other conversation about whether journalists can, you know, have a night to put everything aside and just chat with their sources like humans. That's a whole other conversation. But I think right now the real source of conflict is the entertainment. We nix it. Absolutely none. You know, we go there, we network. It's fantastic networking. You see and be seen. You have rubber chicken. You have your free drinks, and you honor the scholarship winners, and you honor your colleagues and your competitors who did great work over the past year, and then you keep dancing the night away. That's not that hard.
Do you think that's possible? I mean, I think that makes sense, given the response I've seen to Michelle Wolf. Do you think that's possible?
I'd be shocked if my industry doesn't learn its lesson from this year, which is that it's just not the time to delve into any sort of controversy related to this president.
Amber Phillips is a political reporter for The Fix blog at The Washington Post. Amber, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
She was a princess, queen of the highway. Sign in the road said, take us to Madre. No one could save her, save the blind tiger. He was a monster, black dressed in leather. She was a princess, queen of the highway.
Of course, there's much more to the story than this. One that continues to flummox Washington. Sure, we can discuss whether the hobnobbing of journalists with politicians is a smart idea, but there remains a lot of controversy over how Michelle Wolf treated Sarah Huckabee Sanders. NBC's Andrea Mitchell said Sanders deserved an apology for the way she was, quote, grossly insulted by Michelle Wolf at the White House Correspondents Association dinner. There was more. Reporters came over to Sanders after the dinner to say how sorry they were. Many posed for pictures with her. The president of the White House Correspondents Association said she regretted Wolf's comment at the dinner, saying, quote, last night's program was meant to offer a unifying message about our common commitment to a vigorous and free press while honoring civility, great reporting, and scholarship winners, not to divide people. Unfortunately, the entertainer's monologue was not in the spirit of that mission. Of course, this is the same person who invited Wolf in the first place, knowing full well the kind of jokes she tells. Erin Gloria Ryan is a senior editor at the Daily Beast, and she's been observing the reactions to Saturday's dinner. Erin, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Well, earlier I spoke with Ashley Parker of the Washington Post, and the usual arguments against the correspondence dinner were discussed, you know, the schmoozing, the removal of the line between journalists and politicians. But what I want to talk to you about, I think, are the reactions everyone seems to have had about Michelle Wolf's routine last Saturday night. How do you see it?
Huh. I have fingers in both the world of, like, comedy and journalism. I write for the Daily Beast, and I also write for a scripted comedy TV show. And one thing that I felt as I was watching Michelle Wolf's set was that it seemed like she was giving voice to a lot of frustration that people who weren't in the ballroom have with the current state of politics and the current state of media. And by that, I mean people who care a lot about what's going on in Washington, who aren't profiting from what's going on in Washington, but who are aware of the way that the press works and are super annoyed with the way that the press is kind of hobnobbing with an administration that, in the view of a lot of Americans, is actively damaging and manufacturing lies. So, you know, the comments about Sarah Huckabee Sanders, for example, you know, a lot of people that I know who pay attention to the news are just don't understand why people who are in the media don't just confront her and say, you're lying. And Michelle Wolf did that. And I think that's what it served as for me. It was like she was sort of an avatar of the frustration of a lot of America.
What Michelle Wolf did, perhaps what many journalists would have loved to have done, in other words, that's not their role, or they don't see it as their role.
Well, I think that's fair. I don't think that it's really necessarily about roles or not roles, but I think the response is a response to the way that people feel about the current state of things, whether or not that's the way that things should be. That's the way that things currently are. So that there are people who are frustrated and don't understand why, if it's not the media's job to question the veracity of statements from the White House, if it's not the media's job, then whose job is it? It's not a comedian. You know, it's not a comedian's job. It's not a teacher's job. It's not. The media is literally there watching what's going on, documenting what's going on, and trying to, and they're supposed to be speaking truth to power. And so I think that Michelle Wolf's monologue, it wasn't very much more harsh than other monologues in the past, like last year, Hasan Minhaj, who was this media at the White House Correspondents Association dinner, called Steve Bannon a Nazi. And there weren't people, you know, rushing to Steve Bannon's defense. This year, I think people are a little bit more hip to the way that Washington press works because they're finally paying a little bit more attention to the way Washington press works. And I think that they find the kind of source greasing that takes place in environments like the White House Correspondents dinner, where people are going up and apologizing to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, perhaps in expectation that she will, when they see that they're apologizing, they're sorry, she was the butt of jokes, that she'll somehow give them more access. That's something that the public sees and notices and doesn't like. And that's why I feel like some people, you know, people inside the room who understand that, well, you actually do have to be nice to your sources if you want to maintain good relationships with them. But outside the room, people are just kind of like, screw that. The sources are bad people and they should be told that they're bad people. And that's where I think the tension is coming from.
Well, and listening to what you're just saying, it sounds like that it wasn't really Sarah Sanders who looked bad after what happened on Saturday, but it's DC journalists.
Absolutely. Although Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Kellyanne Conway were both kind of mugging like they'd been practicing in a mirror to look upset about jokes. Like, come on. Everybody in that room knows what comedy is. Everybody in that room knows what a roast is. And to act shocked by a fairly mild roast by roast standards. I've been to roasts where I've been shocked that people haven't burst into tears and run out of the room. That was maybe about a 3 on a roast scale of 1 to 10. I think that the media, by performatively rushing to defend Sarah Huckabee Sanders from really, really mild jokes in the face of what jokes could have been made, and rushing to try to pull in her status as a wife and mother, as Mika Brzezinski did, as somehow reason that she shouldn't be made fun of, I found that very pathetic and coddling and sort of almost infantilizing in a way that was nakedly sympathetic.
When you see the president, as he did Saturday night in Michigan, when you see him pointing out, you know, he's literally pointing out the lying media, the lying reporters, the enemy of the American people. And when you hear Sarah Sanders parrot that line, how does one weigh that with the calls for apologies for Sarah Sanders' hurt feelings?
I really don't care about Sarah Sanders' hurt feelings. I think Sarah Sanders has a big, important job, and if she can't handle big, important criticism, then she doesn't deserve to be in that job. I think it's really rich to see, with all the whining on the right about liberal snowflakes and safe spaces, that there are so many people who are so incapable of handling any form of criticism that has anger behind it. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders' job is, you know, it's something that puts her in the line of criticism. That is part of the job. Now, Michelle Wolf's jokes about Sarah Huckabee Sanders referenced the fact that she has an appearance. It did not make fun of her appearance. It did not make fun of anything, you know, how she looks, anything, how she dresses, anything like that. It mentioned that she has smoky eye makeup. It mentioned that her role as a defender of an administration that many critics would say is misogynist is reminiscent of Aunt Lydia from The Handmaid's Tale. You know, it was fair critiques of her job performance. And if Sarah Huckabee Sanders being a wife and a mother or making sad faces during a dinner means that she doesn't get criticized, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Then just put a woman in that job all the time and then nobody can ever get criticized. That's a ridiculous proposition.
I thought this, what I'm going to play right now, I think this was the most instructive line Wolf said on Saturday.
Should have done more research before you got me to do this.
The correspondents did an association knew who she was, and they're stunned that she said these things and demanding an apology.
You know, Michelle Wolf is a really great comic, but she's also been around quite a bit. It's not like she was an underground person that they found working in the cellar that they just pulled up at the last minute. She has an HBO special. She has a Netflix special coming. She's been on The Daily Show a lot. She wrote for Seth Meyers, and she's open for some really big acts. So I think pleading ignorance is ridiculous, and the more backpedaling that happens around Michelle's set, the more ridiculous and bad everybody looks who's involved with it.
If what Michelle Wolf said on Saturday night spells the end of the correspondence dinner as we know it, would that be a terrible thing?
I always thought the correspondence dinner was something that I've always been sort of, you know, watching it as an outsider. I've always felt like there was something kind of gross about it. I think that there might be something good at its core, but I think if it's going to continue to exist, then there needs to be somebody who's there to call out the gross elements of it or the parts that the American people don't quite understand. You know, there are ways to honor what journalists do and the role of the press in a free democracy, but there's also space for criticism, and humor is a good conduit for criticism. And so I would say that I think that, you know, I would like to have seen twice as much Michelle Wolf on Saturday. I think that's the only part of the dinner that people are really talking about, and it's the only part of the dinner that people will remember.
Erin Gloria Ryan is a senior editor at The Daily Beast. You can follow her on Twitter at Morning Gloria. Erin, thanks a lot for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by news.
time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, who was the last first lady born in the same hometown as her husband? The answer, Rosalynn Carter. Both Rosalynn and Jimmy Carter were born in Plains, Georgia. Rosalynn in 1927, 3 years after her husband. And the winner is Jim Spees of St. Louis, Missouri. Jim wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutton winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The last contest led off with a 10th anniversary Taft High School button from 1951, then a button from New York's First Avenue Pharmacy, one that read, I'm a freeze voter 84, and finally an anti-Vietnam War button that simply said, out now. So when you combine 10th with Avenue, with Freeze, with Out, you kind of get 10th Avenue Freeze Out, the Bruce Springsteen song from 1975. And the winner is Adrian Dobson of Eureka, California. We'll have a new scuttlebutton puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Did Joss on the city bird scooter searching for his groove? Seemed like the whole world walking pretty and you can't find more room to move. Well, everybody better move over, that's all. Cause I'm running on the bad side and I got my back to the wall. Tell the devil to freeze out.
There were problems with the nomination of Ronny Jackson to be the next Veterans Affairs Secretary from the outset. But once he was nominated, a nomination that stunned not only White House aides but lawmakers on Capitol Hill, alarming allegations began seeping out. The problem, of course, they weren't proven or documented, but they filled the headlines. Ronny Jackson was accused of writing himself prescriptions for Percocet, occasions of drunkenness, including one time when he allegedly wrecked a government vehicle. These allegations came from the staff of the ranking Democrat on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, John Tester of Montana, but the concern among lawmakers was bipartisan. The report cited unnamed individuals who brought their complaints to the committee. Tester spoke about this to CNN's Anderson Cooper last Wednesday.
And I understand he had a nickname in the White House of the White House staff.
And it was the Candyman because he handed out prescription drugs like they were candy.
The White House doctor, his nickname among some people in the White House was the Candyman.
That's correct. That's what we were told.
By Thursday morning, his support having evaporated, Jackson withdrew his name from consideration. On Saturday morning, President Trump tweeted that Senator Tester should resign. And later that day, at a rally in Michigan, the president continued his assault.
Senator John Tester of a really great place, Montana, who voted, by the way, in favor of sanctuary cities, who's weak on the border, didn't vote for tax cuts. He took a gentleman who is a truly high-quality human being. And what they said about him, what they said about this great American doctor, Ronny Jackson, an admiral in the Navy. He served three presidents. President Obama said he was fantastic. President Bush said he was fantastic. I say he's fantastic. This is a high-quality individual like they would love in Montana. And Tester started throwing out things that he's heard. Well, I know things about Tester that I could say, too. And if I said him, he'd never be elected again. But I'll tell you, what John Tester did to this man is a disgrace.
Tester is seeking a third term this year in a red state that Trump carried by 20 percentage points over Hillary Clinton. It's not going to be easy. Mike Dennison is covering the race for the MT television network, where he's a chief political reporter. Mike, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, if the country was unfamiliar with the name John Tester before, that's no longer the case. President Trump has made him his number one target.
That's right. That was quite the surprise to us that he would be singled out in that fashion. Although, you know, we knew that this was going to be a big election anyways. I mean, Tester's a Democrat in a red state. We knew it would be a tough race for him, and he's being targeted by Republicans as potentially vulnerable. So I don't think it should come as a surprise to anyone that he's in the sights of Republicans nationwide.
Yeah, that's true. But Trump seems to be fixated on him. Even before Saturday's rally in Michigan, Trump had him in his crosshairs. Here was the president Thursday on Fox and Friends.
And I watched what John Tester of Montana, a state that I won by like over 20 points, they love me and I love them. And I want to tell you that John Tester, I think this is going to cause him a lot of problems in his state. I think John Tester has to have a big price to pay in Montana, because I don't think people in Montana, the admiral is the kind of person that they respect and admire.
First of all, with this nonstop barrage from the president, has Senator Tester responded at all?
He hasn't really responded other than to issue statements. He has not yet talked directly to reporters from Montana, like in front of a TV camera or on the record to any other reporter in the state yet.
But, I mean, I can't imagine that he would like to get into a battle with Trump, who I assume remains very popular in Montana.
You know, we haven't seen any polls, but we assume that he's pretty popular. He's certainly popular with a Republican base. And Senator Tester, I'm sure he'll be talking to reporters here, I think, in the next couple of days. This week, he's up working on his farm up in northern Montana. There's been some flooding up on his farm. He spent the week there doing a lot of things he needs to do to take care of that farm. And he's told us that he's going to be talking to us toward the end of the week.
There was a Republican debate last week, and all four candidates running in the June 5th primary faulted Tester for the process that ended in Ronny Jackson withdrawing his name. Has this become, I know it was an issue in the debate, has this been an issue in Montana? Are voters hearing about this?
Well, I think they are. I mean, the day that it happened, Mr. Jackson withdrew, Republicans started attacking Mr. Tester. And I can't recall if they took the cue from Trump initially or if they did it before he did. But at that debate, I mean, I asked the question of one of the candidates, so you're just saying that we should just take Mr. Jackson and confirm him and not look into some of these allegations against him? And as you said, every candidate there went after Tester and saying that he had done a disservice by saying these things about Mr. Jackson without knowing whether they're true or not. And I was a little surprised, but later on I thought about it, and I shouldn't have been surprised, because if you're running in the Republican primary in Montana, the people who are going to be voting in that primary are the Republican base. It's an open primary, and so the dedicated Republicans are the ones that you are going to be catering to. And so they're catering directly to that base when they said those things, and that's who they want to vote for them in the primary.
And while Tester has spent all this time trying to cultivate a moderate image, Republicans are trying to tear that down.
John Tester thinks that crew cut of his makes him one of us. A crew cut doesn't make you a Montana conservative, John. Not when you vote with Elizabeth Warren to shut down the government or join Bernie Sanders to put illegal immigrants over sick kids in Montana. Nope. Not when you vote with Nancy Pelosi on EPA regulations that hurt Montana farmers. And especially when you vote with Barack Obama 93% of the time, but only 37% with President Trump. So cut the crew cut cover up, John, because underneath, you've become just another Washington liberal.
By the way, I love that ad, but by the way, that weird sound you were hearing that sounded like a bee, that was the sound of a razor shaving the heads, you know, giving a buzz cut to Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama and all those liberals. It was kind of funny.
That approach that you just heard in that ad, I mean, this is the approach that is often taken against Tester during re-election time, saying he's just another Washington Democrat. And I actually did a story this week about what is his voting record vis-a-vis President Trump and the Republicans and Democrats in Congress. And what it showed was that he voted with the president 52% of the time on votes where the president actually took a position. Now, a lot of those were, you know, confirmation votes in the Senate. And then we also showed that his party unity with fellow Democrats in the Senate, it was, I think, about 86-87%, which is actually relatively low compared to the rest of the Democrats. He's not as low as someone like Joe Manchin. But you look at his record, I think you can say that he probably has a, you know, a moderate voting record for a Democrat.
Although I noticed that he did not vote on there was some vulnerable Democrats who voted for Mike Pompeo for to be Secretary of State. He was not among them. So he still takes gutsy votes against the Trump administration. And I guess he's just going to wait to see how it plays in Montana for November.
Oh, yeah. He's taken some votes. I mean, you look at a lot of the big issues. He's voted against the president. He voted against the tax cuts. He voted against Neil Gorsuch's confirmation. He voted against Betsy DeVos' confirmation. You mentioned the one Pompeo. He's taken a lot of votes on a lot of key issues against the president, no doubt about it.
I mean, he sounds like he never wants to back down from a fight, but it's pretty rare that the president of the United States, no matter who the president is, will single out a particularly senator for defeat, and that's what Trump seems to be doing with Tester.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what Tester has to say when we talk to him later this week. You should also know that in a state like Montana, where Trump, I think, remains fairly popular, Tester does not go out of his way to criticize the president. He very, very reluctantly does so. And in fact, his first campaign ad was talking about how many bills he's sponsored that have been signed by the president. So he's saying, I'm working with the president when I can to get these things passed.
I don't know how much it costs to run a campaign in Montana. I know it's a huge state with not a lot of people, but I assume that there's going to be tons of money for both sides being poured into the state before November.
Yes, I don't think it'll be quite as big as his 2012 race, which was a $50 million race. That was money spent by the campaigns and outside groups. That was a huge race against the incumbent congressman from Montana at the time, Danny Rehberg. This one we think will probably be between, you know, $30 and $40 million being spent. You know, Tester himself has already raised $11 million, but the Republican nominee is going to come out of the primary probably with not a lot of money, but it's going to be a lot of dough spent on this race in Montana, certainly.
I'm not sure how many states President Trump wants to campaign in November, but Montana may be one of those where a personal visit from the president might be in the making.
Well, I think it may come sooner rather than later. I mean, just this week, one of the White House personnel was talking to a radio show saying that the president was looking at his schedule to find a place where he can come out to Montana and talk about this. In fact, we've asked the White House this week, okay, when's he coming?
And what are they saying?
They haven't replied yet. I've asked the White House if he's going to come, when he's going to come. And also, when the president said he knows a few things about John Tester, that if he said them out loud, Tester would never get elected, we've asked the White House, well, what are they?
Tester knows he's in for a fight, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. And he said that from the beginning, that it's going to be a close race. And I think most people who follow politics in Montana know this will be a close race. No one in the Tester camp is saying, oh, yeah, we're going to skate here. This is going to be easy. No one on the Republican side is thinking it's going to be easy either. They know it's going to be a hard-fought battle right down to the wire.
Mike Dennison is the chief political reporter for the MT Television Network in Helena, Montana. Mike, it was great having you on the program.
Always glad to be here, Ken.
It's been a beaut. Thanks so much.
Okay. Ronnie, 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 I am regretting, but can't stop forgetting because you were my first one.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.